Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Because you listen to this show, Babbel has a very special offer for you. Go to babbel.com and select the language of your choice. Once you try for free and are ready to sign up, select the 3-month option and Babbel will give you 3 additional months for free with promo code BABBELNEWS. That's right. You will get 6 months for the cost of 3 with promo code BABBELNEWS. Go to babbel.com and enter promo code BABBELNEWS. Babbel. Speak a new language with confidence.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 17th of October, these are our main stories. British and EU officials say they've reached agreement on a new draft Brexit deal, but as we'll hear from London and Brussels, there are still many challenges and obstacles ahead. The US Vice President is in Turkey, urging an end to the military offensive against Syrian Kurds. We'll hear from the front line. And Nigerian police have freed dozens of people who had been kept in shocking conditions in an Islamic school.
The experience of hunger, the experience of inhumanity, the experience of bullying, the experience of molestation.
Also in this podcast, a second day of chaos in Hong Kong's legislature, with opposition members heckling the chief executive, Carrie Lam, and scientists have discovered the fastest species of ant on Earth. We'll find out more about these tiny but agile creatures. First to Brussels, where the European Union and the British government have agreed a new draft Brexit proposal, marking the way towards the UK's withdrawal from the EU. Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, made the initial announcement.
We have found a deal with the British government on the orderly withdrawal of the United Kingdom from the European Union, and also on the framework of our future relations.
And shortly before we recorded this podcast, a joint statement was made in Brussels by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Jean-Claude Juncker, the European Commission President. Mr. Juncker told reporters that Brussels was satisfied.
It provides certainty where Brexit creates uncertainty. It protects the rights of our citizens, and it protects peace and stability on the island of Ireland. There will be no border on the island of Ireland, and the single market will be protected.
And Mr. Johnson went on to urge British MPs to vote for the deal.
I hope very much now, speaking of elected representatives, that my fellow MPs in Westminster do now come together to get Brexit done, to get this excellent deal over the line and to deliver Brexit without any more delay, so that we can focus on the priorities of the British people, improving our health service, investing in 20,000 more police, lifting up the living wage, and many, many other things.
But despite these positive statements, it's all far from settled. A party in Northern Ireland whose support is seen as crucial to getting the deal through the UK Parliament says it is unlikely to accept the current proposals. The Democratic Unionist Party leaders had released a statement saying that as things stand, we could not support what is being suggested. So what is different about this deal from the previous one negotiated by Theresa May? Our correspondent Chris Morris is in Brussels.
I'd say 90% of it remains the same, but the key change, and we know this has been the toughest issue certainly for the last year and more, is what the new deal proposes as a solution to the Irish border, the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, which will be the only land border after Brexit between the European Union and the United Kingdom. And what became known as the backstop has gone to be replaced by something of an interesting experiment, really, a dual customs system, which will see the legal customs border between Ireland and Northern Ireland at the land border between those two countries, but the practical border, the de facto border where checks actually take place, would be between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, in other words, within the United Kingdom. that essentially preserves an important red line of both sides. Now, it's a convoluted system, and frankly, it's a system which isn't in place anywhere in the world at the moment, and that's why there's been so much discussion about many of the technical and legal details. That, I think, is probably the biggest change, along with the way in which Northern Ireland then subsequently gives its democratic consent for those changes to continue. And on both of those issues, customs and consent, crucially, the British government's allies in Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionist Party, are not happy. And we know that Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, probably needs the votes of DUP MPs in the House of Commons if he is to get the UK Parliament to approve his new deal.
So we've had this announcement today. What happens next on the European side in the immediate future?
Well, sort of hit and hope in a way, and think, well, we've sort of done our bit. You said you wanted a deal by a slightly self-enforced deadline, Prime Minister Johnson. We've given you one. Now prove that you can get it backed up in Parliament. So EU eyes will turn towards the expected vote in the House of Commons on Saturday on this deal. I suspect there will be some discussion at this summit about what happens if that deal is turned down by MPs, rejected again. Don't forget, Theresa May's version of the withdrawal agreement was rejected three times. And without the support of 10 DUP members of Parliament, the numbers are very, very tight for Boris Johnson to get this deal through the House of Commons. If it doesn't get through, then there is going to have to be a discussion, I think, now on the EU side about how they would respond to that. And the only likely response would have to be an extension, another extension to the Brexit negotiating period, probably in advance of a UK general election, which I think everyone, including me, would hope would produce some kind of clear majority for one path forward or another.
That was Chris Morris in Brussels. Here in London, the British Deputy Prime Minister Michael Gove was upbeat about the deal.
It's a very good deal. It means that we take back control of our money, our borders and our laws, and the whole United Kingdom leaves the European Union as one country, whole and entire. And that means that the people of Northern Ireland, like the people of the rest of the United Kingdom, can benefit from Brexit, including the new free trade deals that we can negotiate.
So what is going to happen next at Westminster? Here's our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
Well, we're expecting the most almighty political battle of the last 3 years. I mean, I say that kind of advisedly because there have been some pretty big ones, but this is going to be huge. And essentially, it's whether Mr. Johnson can get this deal. And let's remember, this deal has been bought at an enormous price, the price of Northern Ireland being treated differently to the rest of the UK, whether he can get that through Parliament. And here's the way things are looking at the moment, that if the Democratic Unionist Party, that Northern Irish party that the government relies on, if they stick to their current position of voting against it, he's going to be in deep trouble.
And just to clarify, what is it that the DUP wants? Why do they matter so much?
They matter because, look, this is a minority government. They matter because some Conservative MPs look to the DUP to see, you know, what are they going to do before they support it? What do the DUP want? Well, they're deeply unhappy about this. They want to be able to sort of block this idea of Northern Ireland being treated somewhat differently to the rest of the UK. Why are they so worried about that? Because it goes to the heart of what do they believe in. They believe in unionism. They believe in the union between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And this deal, which envisages Northern Ireland having a much closer relationship to the EU than the rest of the UK, is a real existential problem for them.
And if Boris Johnson doesn't get this through Parliament, then what?
Another massive fight. I mean, if that wasn't enough, then the next big fight goes something like this. Parliament has passed a law saying if there's no deal that's been agreed, you have to ask the European Union for an extension. Mr. Johnson has said he would rather die in a ditch than do that. So we have the mother of all circles to be squared.
That was Rob Watson, our political correspondent. And if you're gripped or baffled, or gripped and baffled by all things Brexit, don't forget that at some point soon, before the end of this month, we hope, we are getting together with the Brexit cast team. Laura Koonsberg, Adam Fleming, Katia Adler and Chris Mason, who will be answering your questions. We have had quite a good number already, but if you have one, just send it to our normal address, globalnewspod@bbc.co.uk, and we will see if they can shed some light on the process for you. Donald Trump, in an extraordinary letter to the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, warned him to avoid becoming the devil in his actions in northeastern Syria. Today, the US Vice President Mike Pence and the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have been in Ankara to try to persuade Turkey to halt its military incursion. They've been meeting President Erdogan, who shows no sign of halting the offensive, despite the threat of American sanctions. On the ground, the fighting in northeast Syria has continued. Speaking to the BBC, a Kurdish journalist, Salih Muslim, described a desperate situation in the border town of Ras al Ain, where Kurdish forces have been trying to hold off a fierce Turkish attack.
They tried all the means, I mean, warplanes, and Ras al Ain is in the zero point of the border. So the shelling is very easy. They are shelling it from everywhere and trying to surround it from the three sides. But till now, they have failed.
So what chance do the Americans have of convincing Turkey to stop its military campaign? A question for our former Turkey correspondent, Mark Lowen.
I think it's highly unlikely, Jackie, particularly in light of this letter, extraordinary letter that was leaked last night from Donald Trump to President Erdogan, using this kind of unbelievably undiplomatic language, saying, don't be a tough guy, don't be a fool, you'll be a devil if good things don't happen, which we are told from the president's office led to President Erdogan screwing up that letter, throwing it in the bin, thoroughly rejecting it and moving into Syria the very same day. So that just shows you how US attempts to put pressure on Turkey have been repudiated. And now I think President Erdogan won't want to be seen to be backing down in light of this letter. And, you know, you've got to remember, Jackie, that Turkey is a very militaristic, bellicose society. It is a place where jingoism runs very, very large indeed. And this military operation against the Kurdish militants is something that is generally supported by large swathes of the population, whether or not you're in favour of President Erdogan or not. And so, you know, he's unlikely to pull back, certainly not for the time being.
Now, of course, Mr. Erdogan is supposed to be travelling to the White House in a month. Is that still on?
Well, we'll have to see whether today's mediation attempts lead to anything at all, and whether, you know, Mike Pence and Mike Pompeo leave Ankara with more bad blood between them. And bear in mind, of course, in the next week or so, President Erdogan is due in Russia to see Vladimir Putin, who is likely to have much more sway over him than Donald Trump. Now, if that meeting goes well, I suppose, or if there could be pressure exerted on Turkey to pull back, possibly that would provide more momentum for him to go to Washington and meet Donald Trump face to face. But for President Erdogan, this is a matter of prestige, of Turkey's national standing and national opinion. And he is a man who tends to dig in his heels when he feels under pressure. He's not going to want to be seen to succumb to American or to Russian pressure.
And just looking at the sort of broader impact of what's going on at the moment, the US troop withdrawal left something of a vacuum in the region, didn't it?
A huge vacuum. It's kind of reshaped Syria in the space of a week. You've had the Kurds pulling back. You've had regime forces loyal to President Assad going into areas of northern Syria that they have not been in since 2012. So they have been very much sort of retaken control and filled the vacuum, backed by Russia and Iran. And of course, you've got the fear of IS, Islamic State fighters now in Syria, because they are no longer being held and guarded by Kurdish fighters, who were the West's main ally on the ground against IS. And now the Kurds have got, you know, other fish to fry and other worries now. So there's been footage of prisons where IS fighters were being held, which are now largely empty. So that is a real concern for Turkey and, of course, for the West.
That was Mark Lowen, our former Turkey correspondent. Catalonia's pro-independence leader Quim Torra has said there should be a new referendum on self-determination. Mr. Torra was speaking in the regional parliament in Barcelona, from where Guy Hedgeco reports.
This announcement will be seen as provocative by the Spanish government. In 2017, pro-independence Catalans defied court orders and staged a referendum, which led to a failed attempt to break away from Spain, triggering the current crisis. On Wednesday, a third consecutive night of disturbances saw pro-independence demonstrators clash with riot police after they had burnt garbage containers and some vehicles in central Barcelona.
That was Guy Hedgeco. Police in Katsina in northwest Nigeria have found nearly 70 men and boys in shackles during a raid on a private Islamic school. The captives said they had been beaten and sexually abused. In a similar case last month, the police rescued hundreds of people from a religious boarding school in a neighbouring state. Our correspondent, Myeni Jones, sent this report.
We're in the part of the school where students brought here for misbehaviour were kept. There's about 5 or 6 7-metre-squared rooms clustered around an open courtyard. The floor is littered with soiled clothes, old mattresses, and there are pots of rotting food dotted around. There's still students here who used to attend the Quranic school walking around. They tell us that up to 40 students would be kept in any one of those rooms in chains. They'd be forced to urinate and defecate in the rooms with other people around them. And the scenes that they describe are horrific.
Government did not know what is happening exactly here, and no one have access to this place. So this place is a hell. There are many experiences that we experience in this house. The experience of hunger, the experience of deprivation, the experience of inhumanity, the experience of bullying, the experience of molestation, the experience of, I don't know how to say it, but thank God now, God has revealed what has been hidden for a very long time. And God has given us another chance to live our lives freely, not like slave trades.
On the streets outside of the school is a quiet residential area. Neighbors are milling around, and many of the students we spoke to said they were frequently brought out here in their chains to receive Quranic lessons. They say many of the neighbors here saw them, but that none of them did anything. Shehu Dauda is a neighbor of the school.
We couldn't do anything. We couldn't report the director of the school to the authorities or police because he is an influential person who is very powerful, and it could have had a negative effect on our families. If I'm arrested as a result, then nobody will be able to pay for my bail. We knew that eventually God would intervene.
All the drug abuse is worse in the more prosperous south of Nigeria. It's still widespread in the north. The UN estimates that at about 3 million people just in the northwest of the country use drugs. There's a lot of stigma attached to it, as well as a lack of rehabilitation centres. And that's led many families to have to turn to religious leaders and institutions to find a solution. The problem with that is that it's a system that's riddled with abuse. Just last month in the neighbouring state of Kaduna, another school was found where there were hundreds of young men and boys kept in chains. President Buhari had called for these schools to be banned earlier this year. But the fact that one's been found right here in his hometown of Daura makes it politically embarrassing for him. It's the second of this type of establishment to have been found in less than a month. Solving the problem of drug use here in northern Nigeria is going to require much more complex solutions than the ones currently being provided.
Myeni Jones was reporting from northwest Nigeria. Still to come in this podcast.
Sten Gustav Tulin received a small bonus for his invention, which he thought would help change the world, not knowing what it would become.
We will find out more about the man and his invention and why his family say he'd be horrified to see how it's shaped our world. 11 of Hong Kong's pro-democracy lawmakers have been hauled out of the Legislative Council chamber after a second day of heckling the chief executive, Carrie Lam. Opposition members waved placards and shouted for Ms. Lam to resign as she prepared to take questions about her annual policy speech. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, told us more.
If you cannot get elected representatives in the same room together, able to talk to each other, able to even listen, not able to listen to each other, then that means that the assembly, which looks at all kinds of legislation coming through Hong Kong, all kinds of committees, that means that work will grind to a halt, which increases the political chaos and crisis in Hong Kong even further. So it's really a ratcheting up of the tension in Hong Kong by moving the protest to the assembly.
Michael Bristow, our Asia-Pacific editor. A US jury has awarded $450,000 to the father of a boy killed in one of the deadliest school mass shootings in US history. 6-year-old Noah Posner was among 26 people shot dead at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, in December 2012. But his father, Leonard, later filed a defamation lawsuit against conspiracy theorist writers who claimed the massacre never happened. In June, a judge in Wisconsin ruled that one of these authors, James Fetzer, had defamed Mr. Posner by claiming he had fabricated his son's death certificate. This claim was made in Mr. Fetzer's book, which is titled Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. After the jury announced the award to Mr. Posner, his lawyer, Jake Zimmerman, spoke to Lawrence Pollard.
The idea of the book is to spin this grotesque tale that Sandy Hook was a government operation designed to support a policy change that would take away the right of Americans to own guns.
And the elaborate background of this, the hoaxness, is the kind of thing that we've heard surrounding this issue. This was just part of a bigger sort of echo chamber. Just describe that for us a bit.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There is a small but relatively active group of people that believe that the United States government is operating against their interest, and they're going to stand up to it and ensure that primarily their gun rights won't be impacted.
And what did you have to prove in court? Because surely he has a right to say what he wants. This is freedom of speech, hugely important issue in America under the Constitution. How did you navigate around that one?
That's exactly right. In the United States, you have a First Amendment right to free speech, but defamation does not have any protection under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. So our obligation was to show that Dr. Fetzer's speech wasn't on the safe side of the line. It instead crossed over into an area of speech that enjoys no constitutional protection. We had to show that the statements were false and that they were the type of statements that tend to injure a person's reputation. Dr. Fetzer argued that my client uploaded a forged or fake death certificate for his son. So we had to prove that the death certificate that he uploaded was not fake or forged or fabricated. In fact, of course, it wasn't. He obtained it from the state of Connecticut, from the clerk's office in the state of Connecticut. It was a real document. To make that proof, we had to first show that his son Noah was a real boy. He was actually born, he actually lived, and he actually died. And we went through a number of steps to get there. We actually performed two rounds of DNA testing from tissue samples, blood samples that were obtained by the coroner's office during Noah Posner's postmortem examination. I tested those against his father, Leonard Posner, in order to demonstrate that Leonard Posner had a son. We introduced pages and pages of evidence of mundane things, medical records showing that there was a boy named Noah Posner in Sandy Hook, Connecticut. And so we were able to build a story to demonstrate that Noah actually lived and that he actually died. And that supported the inference that the death certificate was a genuine document.
What was it like? Can you just give us an idea? I mean, you're a lawyer and you're speaking very dispassionately, but what was it like for Mr. Posner going through this, having to prove that his son was his son and having to prove that his son had been killed?
It's just as horrible as you believe it would be. Going to court to prove that your boy was actually a real person and that he actually was murdered is incredibly difficult. Everything about litigation like this is incredibly difficult. Mr. Posner had to talk about how hard it was to kiss his son goodbye one last time before he had to bury his son. And he had to do it in front of a room full of complete strangers.
Does this case have any implications for protecting people in that extraordinary situation going forward?
Yeah, I think it does. And it does that because it sends a message to this entire hoaxer community. So what we saw was a Wisconsin jury speaking to the level of damage that a relatively small player like Fetzer has done. But soon, a Texas jury is going to speak to the level of damage done to Mr. Posner and to others by Alex Jones and InfoWars. And they copy statements from relatively obscure people like Fetzer, spread them online, and make money on a massive scale. We certainly hope that this will influence people like Fetzer or others to not go after victims and choose to injure people who are already subjected to the worst possible thing you can imagine as a parent.
U.S. lawyer Jake Zimmerman speaking to Lawrence Pollard. And we have heard that James Fetzer plans to appeal. The leader of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, has been injured in a motorcycle accident. He was riding around the presidential compound and apparently crashed while trying to reach his shoe. From Manila, here's Howard Johnson.
According to the president's spokesperson, Salvador Pinelo, Mr. Duterte was reaching for his shoe when he fell from his bike. The accident resulted in a minor injury, and the president is said to be feeling pain in his hips. Aides say Mr. Duterte is currently resting and will be checked by doctors later today. Last week, it was revealed that the 74-year-old is suffering from a rare autoimmune disease that is causing one of his eyelids to droop. Persistent rumours about his health have swirled since taking office in 2016, driven by his reputation for occasionally skipping official events. The Philippine Constitution stipulates that the public must be informed of the state of the president's health in case he has a serious illness.
That was Howard Johnson in Manila. When the humble plastic bag was invented some four decades ago, it was seen as a neat and durable solution. But they have been blamed for creating an environmental crisis in many parts of the planet. Now, the family of the man who created the plastic bag says he'd be shocked and upset to see the damage his invention has caused. Here's our environment reporter, Laura Foster.
It was once a symbol of convenience, but now the plastic bag is considered to be an environmental curse. As we see more and more are thrown away, more people are realising the problems they can cause the planet.
They end up in the stomachs of sea creatures. We're ruining the oceans.
They are just being dumped and harming ecosystems.
I just think they're a waste of time. I don't think it should be used.
At this house in Oxfordshire in England, one lone plastic bag dangles from the kitchen door handle. Not that unusual, you may think. But this place has a special connection to this invention.
To my dad, the idea that people would simply throw these away would be bizarre.
That's Raoul Tulin. His father, Sten Gustav Tulin, invented the plastic bag in Sweden in 1959, inspired after seeing how many trees were being chopped down to make paper bags.
From an early age, we were aware that he'd been very much involved in the development of the plastic bag. He'd take us into the factory from time to time and we'd go and see the big machines whirring around acres of plastic and seeming to go whirring at 100 miles an hour.
He says his father deliberately built the bags to be strong and to last so they could be reused again and again. A better alternative to paper bags which split or become weak when wet.
It was just something he had with him. So, you know, what we're all being encouraged to do today, which is to take your own bags to the shop, he was doing back in the 70s and 80s, just naturally, because, well, why wouldn't you? I think he would have been shocked at how wasteful we are now.
So now we've got this anti-plastic bag thing, and people are rushing to use paper bags or cotton bags.
Professor Margaret Bates is an expert in sustainable waste management from the University of Northampton.
The problem with plastic isn't a problem with plastic, because the environmental impact of a plastic bag is actually less than a paper bag or a cotton bag or any of the other alternatives, as long as it's dealt with correctly at end of life.
Paper and cotton bags don't contribute to plastic pollution, but creating these items leaves other marks on the planet.
They use more energy, they use a lot of water to produce, and they're heavier as well. So depending on where they're made, there's an extra environmental impact of transporting them to the shops as well. So all of those factors build in to give them a higher environmental impact. Cotton bags are, on a life cycle basis, even worse. Cotton uses a lot of water and it is quite an intensive crop to produce. So this is the same concerns we've got with some of the fast fashion issues at the moment as well.
The most environmentally friendly thing to do is to keep reusing a bag you already own. Sten Gustav Tulin received a small bonus for his invention, which he thought would help change the world, not knowing what it would become.
That was Laura Foster, our environment reporter. And finally,
up and at 'em, it's adamant. His strength, his might, his speed, his fight. He's Atom Ant, that tiny ant.
The opening of Atom Ant there, the TV cartoon series about a super speedy ant. Well, now researchers have found the fastest ant in the world, and Terry Egan has been finding out more.
Now, many think of ants as creepy crawlies, but they are pretty fast. But this is the fastest in the world. It's named the Saharan silver ant after where it was found. And researchers have been studying it in Tunisia. They captured the ants on camera after finding them thriving in the dunes there. Though, because they're so fast, they still had to lure them out and trap them in a kind of channel so they could be filmed.
Just how fast are they?
This ant, it can cover more than a metre in a single second. It's 7 or 8 millimetres long, so that's 108 times its body length every second. And now, in human terms, that's the same as you or me, Jackie, running 600 kilometres per hour. Now, I don't know how that suits you, but it's more than 20 times faster than the sprinter Usain Bolt. And in proportion to its body size, this ant is faster than a cheetah, putting it up there with the fastest creatures on Earth.
So how do they do that then?
Well, for some ants, it has comparatively short legs, this one, surprisingly, but it swings those legs incredibly quickly. If Usain Bolt makes 4 strides a second, this ant makes 50 strides. And then when it gears up, it switches to a gallop so that all the feet are off the ground at the same time. Not a bad idea, as it probably stops those legs sinking in the sand. But what's more, if you think about, you know, those athletes in Dubai and the heat there, this ant does it in the hottest place on Earth, the Sahara. Not only that, but because they come out of their nest to scavenge on dead and rotting animals, back to those creepy crawlies, I'm afraid, they do it at the hottest time of day. And they need that speed, of course, to get them through the heat. But as I said, it's called the Saharan silver. And they also do that, getting through the heat, using the silver hairs on their back. And these reflect the sun back up into the sky. So no end of marvels with this creature.
Terry Egan, who's also surprisingly fast for someone with short legs. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, or you have questions for the Global News Brexit Cast special, or you just want to send us pictures of your dog, thank you, Brooke Beveridge, I was talking to you. You know how to do it. Just send us an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.